And welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Our guest today, Bob Berman, author of several books on astronomy, a regular contributor to Astronomy Magazine, the astronomy editor of the Old Farmer's Almanac. Bob has a worldwide following. Always great to have him back on the show. If you've heard Bob before, you know that he has a knack for making even the most complicated concepts easy to understand. Get in the queue early, 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Support comes from Munson Williams Proctor Arts Institute, Utica, New York, featuring Shadow of the Sphinx, Ancient Egypt and Its Influence, MWPAI.org. Bob Berman, welcome back, my friend.
Great to be here. Thanks, Ray.
So my first question for you before we get to the calls is, you know, we had this awful Hurricane Sandy, and obviously millions without power still. We just heard the news. The mayhem and the destruction is almost unparalleled for this neck of the woods. And one of the things the people on the Weather Channel mentioned a lot as this storm was approaching was it was likely to make landfall at the time of the full, at the, A, the high tides, B, the full moon. And I thought, well, why exactly? The moon is more or less the same distance away, and I thought we were just seeing more of the moon when it's full, but there's a reason why that was such a big deal, right?
Right. Every single month when the moon and the sun are in the same line at new moon and full moon, their tidal forces add together. You know, the moon's tidal force on Earth is a little more than twice what the sun's is, but the sun's is not nothing. At first and last quarter, that is, at the half moon, they fight each other. They subtract each other. So the tides are wishy-washy, what we call neap tides. The highs are not very high. The lows are not very low. But at the flood tides, the greatest tides, what are called spring tides, as if they spring out at you, as if there's a spring of water. It's an old word, an old concept. That happens at the full moon and a day after full moon, and at the new moon and a day after full moon. New moon, because the sun and the moon are pulling on the same plane towards Earth, and so the tides are absolutely maximal. So what we had was a high tide that happened within a few hours after the very moment of the full moon, the Hunter's Moon at that, the second most famous full moon of the year, just as the hurricane was nearing shore. So the combination of those three is what produced those amazing 13-foot tidal surges.
So it's really the sun. In other words, they say the full moon, but really it was the addition of the sun
to that
was.
That's right.
And interesting in what you just said, the new moon has exactly the same effect.
They do, exactly.
Very interesting indeed. 1-800-348-2551. Now, I mentioned at the start of the show that you write for Astronomy Magazine, and you told me before we started that one piece that you recently did has garnered more feedback than any other one.
That's right. We've just been overwhelmed with it. In the November issue of Astronomy Magazine, the current issue, my page is about infinity, the infinite universe.
Yeah.
And it's really only this year that we could say with, I think, some confidence that it really looks like the universe is infinite in extent. When we were kids, maybe we asked our parents and said, do the stars just go on and on? And of course, our parents didn't know. And some of them may have said, yes, they just go, the galaxies and stars just go on and on and on. Well, it turns out they were right if they said that. Because earlier this year, a team from Berkeley made an announcement of their largest ever survey of galaxies. 900,000 galaxies were surveyed. The largest large-scale study of the universe, and it found that space is flat. The topology of space-time is flat, meaning that a ray of light doesn't curve in the slightest, no matter how far we look. And this would only be the case in either an infinite universe or a universe that was so much larger than what we can see, the observable universe, that it's close to infinite.
I mean, isn't that more likely, though? I mean, if I stood on I-90 in Montana and looked, it would, to me, appear that it was infinite. But in fact, it is not. Isn't it just a question that it's as far as we can see at this time?
Well, that's the issue, is how far can we see? And once we are looking to 10, 12 billion light years, and there's not even the slightest trace of a curvature of space-time, not the slightest trace. This flat topology of space is a very strong argument. Now, using Occam's razor, that the simplest explanation is usually the right one, we're left with two choices. Either everything we can ever see, that is the Big Bang and the universe is created, which now looks more and more like just a local event,
yeah,
and not the birth of the universe, but just birth of the hood,
yeah,
of the neighborhood,
yeah,
that the universe is far larger, and we're talking about at least 100 times larger than this, or it's actually infinite. Now, infinite does away with some problems, because no matter how large the universe is, we always think of it as, well, what's outside of that? Whence did it come?
Yeah.
Was there a birth and all the rest of it? If the universe is eternal and infinite, well, that's the end of the story, even though infinity isn't anything that theoretically exists in a physical way. You know, infinity is a mathematical abstraction. You can't have infinity, but any other visualization of the universe comes creates equal problems. So the bottom line is that most cosmologists, or at least more and more of them, now regard, after this year at least, it's sort of cinched the case, even though you're not reading about it yet in the New York Times or other places, that the universe really is infinite. And given that space is homogeneous, that is, everywhere it contains the same density of stars and galaxies. That's an assumption, but if that's true, that means the galaxies and the stars are also infinite in number.
All right, well, let's go to the phones, and we go to Merle in Argyle. You're first today.
All right, good deal. Hi, guys. How you doing?
Good.
I just have a, I got two questions, actually. It's just a follow-up question on what you were talking about, the moon and the tides. You said there's a delay of an hour, hour and a half, from full tide, from when it's officially full moon, and then an hour later.
Yeah, that didn't really matter. Full moon was about 4 p.m. that day, and the high tide was 8:30 in some places, 9 o'clock in other places in the New York Harbor area. That didn't matter. The hour that it's full doesn't matter. In fact, the greatest tidal effects occur one day after the full moon. So the fact that it didn't coincide to the hour had no influence on it.
Oh, I thought you were implying that the highest tide with the full moon was delayed by an hour.
No.
Okay, I misheard something. All right, this has to do with asteroids or meteors, actually meteors.
All right.
For the last year or 6 months anyway, this is just my observations looking out the south window between, or south porch between 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, and just watching the sky when I have chances to see the stars. And I see meteors, and then I've always been under the impression they come in from all different directions when they hit the atmosphere. But everything I see is either coming from the northwest or the northeast. Occasionally I might, or at least I think I see something going from east to west, but I never see anything going from west to east.
Okay.
Or south to north.
All right. What do you think, Bob?
That's the best time to look at meteors, the times that you have in the wee hours of the morning, because on average there's 6 an hour. Any clear night after midnight, between midnight and dawn, there are 6 an hour. We call them sporadics because they can come from any direction, and they do cross the sky in any direction. You've just gotten lucky or unlucky in that you've preferentially seen them moving in one direction. Now, the exception are the meteor showers, the Perseids on August 11th, the Leonids on November the night of 17th to 18th, the Geminids coming up, which should be the best shower of the year
this year,
and that's December 13th. They do come from one preferential direction. So on a night of a meteor shower, or within a few nights before and after that, you will get more meteors in one direction than another. We had that with the Orionids about 2 weeks ago.
All right.
Well, I think I was out there, but I really didn't see much.
Yeah. All right, Merle, hey. Thanks a lot.
All right, so it's just bad luck then.
Bad luck or good luck, because you enjoy them no matter what direction they come from, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay, there you
go. Okay, thanks, Merle. Let's go to Stuart in Bennington. Stuart, you're on.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi.
Diamond, Bob, God bless you.
Well, thank you.
I was curious, Skyman Bob, about how the Little Dipper moves around the North Star and how the timing works with that, and also if you could touch upon any experiences that you've had to look at the astronomical alignments of the Great Pyramid. Thank you.
Okay. Are you hanging up, or are you going to stay with us, Stuart?
I can hang up.
It's up to you.
Thank
okay.
You.
Okay.
Well, the Little Dipper, the bowl of the Little Dipper in particular, makes a turn around the North Star, Polaris, counterclockwise as we watch, as the minutes and as the hours go on. It's making a rather small circle counterclockwise, mm-hmm. and it makes a complete circle in 1 day minus 4 minutes. In 23 hours, 56 minutes, and 4.1 seconds, it'll have completed one circle. So that, in other words, it's night to night, it's advanced by about 4 minutes. So
okay.
that's the motion. And so far as the Great Pyramid goes, I had the pleasure of visiting it, and it is the most precisely aligned structure of the ancient world. It's aligned to the cardinal directions by with an accuracy of within 1/10 of a degree. And by comparison, Polaris, the North Star, is off from true north by a little more than half a degree. So the pyramids are more accurate than the North Star itself, and they are aligned north, south, east, west. Of course, this is a four-sided pyramid, not a three-sided pyramid in Giza or the other pyramids
yeah.
that are there. And they are all precisely aligned with the cardinal directions.
So, assuming they used the stars to align, yes. how did they do it to be so precise?
Well, with great care. That's just
well,
shows.
Well, that's a cop out, Bob.
No, well, it's not. What I'm saying, Ray, is it's not something supernatural. I know people are going to. People tend to think, well, do they have help from aliens? You don't. You just have to be.
Well, putting aside the alien idea for a moment, how do you do that?
Okay, one way to do it is on the dates of the equinoxes, on March 20th and September 23rd. They were on slightly different dates then. The sun will rise and set precisely east and west. Mm. Precisely. It'll be off not even by 1/10 of a degree.
Mm-hmm.
So you can use that. And once you have east-west, you can use any triangle, any right triangle you can create, such as what Pythagoras showed us,
mm-hmm.
To create a right angle. And there you have north-south. So you can start with the corners of your structure being precise and go from there and check it periodically to make sure you're doing it correctly.
All right, Bob Berman is our guest. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. More with Skyman Bob coming up.
Support for WAMC comes from St. George's School, Clifton Park, New York, sponsoring the first annual Clifton Park 5K Turkey Trot Thanksgiving morning, November 22nd, stgeorgecp.org. Don Muller Gallery, Northampton, Massachusetts, specializing in jewelry, custom designs, handcrafted glass and gifts by American artists since 1978. Facebook and donmullergallery.com. The Nature Conservancy's Adirondack Chapter, working to preserve freshwater resources that flow from the Adirondacks to New York's urban centers, nature.org/Adirondacks. And the Calvin Theater in Northampton, presenting Lyle Lovett and his acoustic group, Saturday, November 3rd, IHEG.com for tickets.
Fox Pop on WAMC. Astronomer Bob Berman is our guest. His most recent book now has been out for almost about a year now, right? It's The Sun's Heartbeat on Little Brown.
That's right. Paperback out just a month or two, but yes.
A good read indeed. Let's
Thank
go
you.
To Dick in New... Where are you calling from, Dick?
New Bern, North Carolina.
Well, I'll be darned. You're listening online, I take it.
That's, well, yeah, I'm listening on my phone right now.
Well, nice to have you here.
Bob, I have a question about the asteroids and Kuiper Belt objects, if I pronounce that right. Is that right?
Kuiper Belt, yes.
Kuiper Belt. All right. I understand that we think that these things were condensed out of the dust cloud when the solar system was formed, and that they're made of ice and some rock or some mixture of the two. My question is, these things are so light and their gravitation is so feeble, how do you make rock out of dust without a lot of heat and pressure?
Hmm. Well, you know, you said it correctly. You said the word ice, and we think that most of them are mostly ice. Remember, this is the repository whence comets come, and comets are mostly ice with some dust and stuff mixed in, kind of dirty ice, mm-hmm. and Kuiper Belt objects are also, and for listeners who for whom this may sound strange, out past the orbit of Neptune, we now know that including Pluto and other objects that are the same size or a little bit smaller. Pluto's about 1,400 miles in diameter, two-thirds the size of our moon. But there are others, which we've now discovered and have names like Quarwar and Sedna and Eris and thousands of others, many of which are too small to have yet been discovered. And they are mostly icy objects that mind their own business, but once in a while one will come too close to another, get a little bit of a gravitational nudge, and then hurl its way inward, and we think that's what supplies some of the comets. And then there's a second, further away reservoir that forms a more spherical halo around the solar system called the Oort cloud, and there's some more stuff out there. So the inner solar system where we live is just kind of like a ship in the bottle, surrounded by these spheres of other stuff, mostly ices.
But does that go for the asteroids, too? I thought a lot of those
were right. No, you're quite right. The asteroids are different. Now, the asteroids, which mostly form between Mars and Jupiter, are indeed, quite right, are rocky and metallic. And so they are much more closely in composition with the first four planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars, which are rocky, stony planets. And the asteroids would have been a fifth planet, but because they tried to form so close to the meddling, the gravitational meddling of Jupiter, they couldn't stick together when the solar system was young, and so they remained as just chunks and pieces, and there still are thousands of them like that.
Okay.
Okay.
Dick, thanks
so
a lot.
How then did the dust form into rock on the asteroids?
Well, we think that early in the solar system, these what we called planetesimals, which were just pieces, chunks, that glommed together. And when you get enough of them, there's enough self-gravity and there's enough heat back then that they would pull together and fuse into what eventually formed the planets. But farther away from the sun, especially with the smaller bodies, they're held much more loosely and they're mostly ices. And that's why it's fragile stuff. And that's why when a comet fragment comes in, it doesn't survive the passage through the atmosphere. Interestingly, all the meteor showers, like the great one we're going to have coming up on December 13th, Geminids, are leftover bits of comets. And because they're mostly ices, they never make it to the ground. Nobody ever finds pieces of them, which then would be called a meteorite. You don't have meteorites from comet fragments. You only have meteorites left over from asteroid fragments.
Dick, thanks a lot for the call. We appreciate it very much. Now, was there not a massive comet strike on Jupiter that caused, I mean, we weren't there, but some sort of damage?
Yes, yes.
So how did that happen?
Yeah, there was Shoemaker-Levy 9 in the mid-90s, and we had a more recent one that didn't leave any scars on Jupiter. And, well, that just proves the point, that pulled in at these tremendously high speeds, especially with Jupiter, with its awesome gravity. Its gravity is 318 times more than ours is. And these objects, they don't survive either their full passage inward, but going through Jupiter's atmosphere, the dusts, the bits of rock that are there, seem to be able to produce temporary discolorations and spots and blotches.
So, and the Tunguska event of 1908 was not a comet then?
That's a little bit more mysterious because whatever it was, June 30th, 1908, blew up in the air maybe 5 miles up, which isn't super surprising. In fact, that argues, Ray, for it probably being a comet unable to survive its passage through the atmosphere. But apparently some asteroids could do that, too. On the way in, they're heated up coming in, and then they just blow up in the air and never make it to the surface.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Jeff in Westerlo. Jeff, you're on.
Thank you. I was listening to somebody. I think the guy's name is German scientist and physicist. And he was talking about free energy from from outer space, and he's talking about Nikola Tesla's technology, where the transmitter transmits, let's say, for argument's sake, a number of 10, we can get a million times more out of the receiver because of the free energy. And I never heard of that before, but I went online and checked Merck. I forget. I'm sorry. I don't have his name on the top of my head. Merck out. And it was very interesting technology where that's how Tesla was able to move energy through the air. And it was directly related to astronomy.
Hmm. Well, let me address that. I'm not sure exactly what you're talking about. Tesla is one thing. The energy from space is another. And the energy from space is fantastic. This is vacuum energy or zero-point energy, and the energy is limitless there. Let me get to that in a moment. With Tesla, he did amazing things. Of course, we owe AC current to him and the idea of transmitting things through the air. And in fact, he really invented the radio wave radio. And if he had just stuck with that, he would have been a gazillionaire. Instead, Marconi took his ideas, Tesla's ideas, and ran with them, essentially. The idea, as you know, Tesla was obsessed with transmitting things through the air. And there's still a following today that thinks the government is suppressing what could have been free energy. Well, there's no such thing. You see, he was right about some things, but wrong about others. It does not make sense to try to send electricity through the air the way Tesla was trying to do and to send it from one place to another, simply because there are tremendous losses. The air has great resistance. Electricity does not flow through the air the way it would along copper wire. And so it's simply cheaper, infinitely cheaper, and has much fewer losses to just use copper wire.
All right, what's zero-point energy?
Now, space, this is fantastic. Since 1948, there have been increasing bits of evidence that all of space, what seems to be the vacuum, is filled with almost unimaginable power, and that emptiness isn't really empty, but that virtual particles pop in and out of existence out of this vacuum energy. It's so powerful that temporary bits of atoms, like snap, crackle, and pop, like fleas on a griddle, just emerge from this emptiness, exist for a tiny fraction of a second, and then subside. If there's a nearby energy place they can borrow energy, like a magnetic field, they can actually become real and remain in existence forever. It's suggested one name for this is zero-point energy, Z-point energy, simply because you start to see it when all other energy is suppressed. All other energy is really kinetic energy, and kinetic energy manifests itself as heat or motion. All the atoms around us in the air, in our bodies, are jiggling. It's moving about the speed of sound right around us here in our rooms. But if you could bring all the energy that's around us, all that moving those atoms to a stop, which happens at absolute zero.
Okay.
That's at 459.67 degrees below zero Fahrenheit. At that point, where you have no other energy, the zero-point energy that pervades space, you're now at equilibrium with it, and it can start to show itself. It shows itself, for example, we believe, by the fact that helium has no solid state naturally. This prevents helium from turning solid. If you could channel this, you see, there's no way we know of to channel it, because how do you make something come to you when it's equally everywhere, no matter how powerful it is? But if you could, well, it's been estimated that an empty mayonnaise jar, a vacuum in a mayonnaise jar, has enough zero-point energy to boil away the Pacific Ocean in one second. In 1 second. That kind of power. And once you use that up, it would flow in again from the rest of the universe. So it would be limitless energy if you found a way to exploit it and make it come to you.
Right.
But there seems to be no way to do that.
Well, I'll get a few mayonnaise jars. We'll do some experiments. Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. That's very interesting, though. So if helium, if you put helium at absolute zero, it does not become a solid?
It never becomes a solid, yes.
Amazing.
Another evidence for it is the Casimir effect, that if you hang two metal plates very close to each other, they snap together. They come together and they get stuck together. And the explanation for that is that the waves of energy from this universal vacuum energy, or sometimes it's called dark energy or Z-point energy, has waves. And once you've put the plates very close to each other, the waves don't have enough elbow room between the plates. But outside of the plates, they still have their same wave energy, and so it pushes the plates close together. It's called the Casimir effect, discovered since 1948, and this is still the best explanation for it.
Wow. Michael in Pittsfield, you're on. Michael.
Hi, I think you just answered my question. I was gonna, I might have another one. The question I was gonna ask was, when you said the universe is infinite, does that mean that there's infinite energy in the universe? Meaning that, because we've been told that someday all the stars will go out and the universe will be dark. But if it's infinite universe, does that mean that would happen, or there would always be energy?
No, it would mean there would always be energy, yes. Even in the current universe that would go, even in the old model where the universe is finite, there still is the same energy that it was born with would never decrease in the slightest. It's just that more of the energy would be converted into matter, and the matter would be turning darker. But it would still be, since matter and energy are equivalent, you'd still have what you started off with. But in an infinite universe, yes, you're right. The energy also would be infinite. And as for trying to visualize this, how do you picture space going on and on without end and limitless galaxies and stars and limitless energy? How do you visualize eternity? And, of course, the answer is you cannot. Our minds work, science works, math works in with symbolism and in dualistic ways. And when you're speaking of the cosmos as a whole, any dualistic thought fails. So because of that, it makes no sense. But just because it makes no logical sense doesn't mean it's not true.
Okay, I got one geek question for you. So now that quantum computers are a thing that we can think of and imagine and are actually being experimented with, does that mean that beaming is someday on the table again?
So beaming of people,
Those are two very different things. Quantum computers work by, we just talked about non-logical or anti-logical events, and in the quantum world of the tiny, we see those all the time. Particles actually exist in what are called superpositions, which are states of being and non-being, states that defy logic. For example, to our logic, a cat, if we have a cat at home, we could say it's either in the room with us or it's not in the room.
Hmm.
Maybe the only other possibility is it's partially in the room. Maybe it's sleeping in the doorway between it.
Yeah.
But that's all the choices we can entertain. But in the quantum world, there are other choices beyond any we can entertain. Imagine if you said the cat is neither in the room, nor is it not in the room, nor is it partially in the room.
Right.
And you could prove that was the case. You'd say, well, that's not possible because those are the only possibilities. Well, that's what happens in the quantum world of the tiny. So that's where we first left our logic behind in the 1920s.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
This is why physicists drink, isn't it? Let's go to Jose in Ackard. Jose, you're on.
Hi, Bob and Ray.
Hello.
Wanted to ask Bob about the fact that recently a planet was discovered orbiting around Proxima Centauri. And I think it's supposed to be fairly close to the size of Earth, but circling much more closer to that star, to Proxima Centauri, than Earth does to the Sun. So anyway, my question is primarily if you can comment on that, on those features of that particular planet. And number two, have we explored Proxima Centauri in its entirety in terms of, are there any other planets in that planetary system that are maybe more amenable to perhaps life than this recently discovered planet?
No, that's the first one. The nearest visible star, naked eye star, is the Alpha Centauri system. It's a double star system, one of which is a twin of our sun, interestingly enough. Our sun only makes up about 13% of the stars of the galaxy are of our sun's type. That is a yellow-white star. We call a G0 or G1 type star. And the nearest star to us is of that type. That's Alpha Centauri. It's got a little companion that's similar to it. But orbiting the two of those is Proxima Centauri, about a tenth of a light year away, located about 4.3 light years away. And so in this very closest star to us, we've now discovered the first planet. As you correctly said, this planet is closer to Proxima than our planet Mercury is to our sun, and so it would be over 1,000 degrees at all times. You couldn't possibly have life there. This has made the news. It's not very exciting to astronomers, simply because for the last 20 years, we have realized, ever since 51 Pegasi was discovered, we realized that there are planets probably around all stars, certainly around most stars, and we found now thousands of them, 500. One group found 500. Now we found indirect evidence of thousands more. And so it's a given that planets are essentially everywhere. So how to make this newsy and make the New York Times? Well, Dennis Overby in the New York Times said, we found now a planet around the closest star. So what you're finding are kind of new ways to keep the juices going, keep the excitement going. Here's the first ever planet around that has this quality or that quality or this thing or this, you know, but to astronomers, it's already, okay, it's a given. It's sort of like once you've discovered the first trout in Lake Michigan, whoever discovered that, finding the 10,000th trout wasn't particularly exciting. And that's where we're at now. We're just finding lots and lots and lots of planets. And
but we know a lot of things about trout. I mean, planets outside of the solar system, we don't know all that much. There are things to learn.
But we're not going to. That's the thing, Ray. That's maybe I should have added that because they are so far away that we can't possibly image them. And if we do get an image, it's a single pixel. So we'll never have, we can never get information about radiation. Do they have a critical killing radiation? Does they have an atmosphere that's amenable to life or not? There are hundreds of parameters that would make a planet potentially life-friendly or not that we can't possibly learn from this distance. So it's going to be a permanent exercise in frustration, I'm afraid. We can tell the rough temperature because of the planet's distance from the star, as we have in this case, so we can eliminate this as a possible abode for life. But what about the planets that we're already starting to find that are at a distance from their parent star that could be Earth-friendly in terms of Earth-like in terms of temperature?
Yeah.
And what if they're Earth mass-like? They have the same kind of gravity. Those are the things we can learn. Well, what else? Unless you send a space probe there, you can't really learn anything else.
Well, no. I mean, if the ultimate goal of, we'll take a break in a moment. Thank you, Jose. If the ultimate goal of all of this is to learn whether we are, in fact, alone or we have company, then if you find a planet that is in the zone, let's say, that would perhaps support life, then if given what you say is true, we'll never be able to find radiation. We'll never be able to. The only thing we can do is point our radio telescopes and listen for signals. It's the only, isn't it the only thing that we can do?
Right, which we've already done, too.
Well, we should keep doing that.
Sure.
All right, let's take a break here. It's 800-348-2551. More calls coming up with the infinite Bob Berman.
Support for WAMC comes from Maria College, Albany, New York, offering RN Baccalaureate Completion Program, Associate Degrees and Professional Certificate Programs, day, evening, weekend, and online classes, mariacollege.edu. East Heaven Hot Tubs and Paradise Spa, Northampton, Massachusetts, offering private hot tub room rentals with indoor or outdoor rooftop tubs, massage for couples and individuals, eastheaven.com for reservations. Unison Arts, New Paltz, presenting a Woody Guthrie Music and Dance Centennial with Vannevar Caravan, SUNY New Paltz Parker Theater, November 3rd at 7:30 p.m., unisonarts.org. And Tom Wall Photography, specializing in a contemporary photojournalistic approach to weddings and portraits for the entire WAMC listening area, tomwallphotography.com.
one 800 348 2551 is our number. Bob Berman is our guest, and back to the phones we go. Boy, what a crackling program we have had so far. Scott in Westfield, you're on.
Hey guys, just a quick question. I don't know how valid it is or not, but it always bothered me that no one ever talked about the distances as they occur. When you see light or you try and measure light coming from somewhere, isn't it going equally in the opposite direction? So therefore, double the distance you can see.
Double the distance you can see. Do you mean that if we're looking at a, let me see if I understand you, that if we're looking at a galaxy that's 10 billion light years away, well, its light also was emitted in the other direction, which means the universe has to be at least 20 billion light years in diameter. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, that's absolutely valid. And in fact, when we look at a distant galaxy, it's only being expressed in light travel time to us. The truth is, A, when the light left, we were much closer to that galaxy than we are now because the universe was smaller. So we may have only been 1 billion light years from the galaxy, even though we say it's 10 billion light years away, because that's what we were when the light started out traveling.
Uh-huh.
B, while the light was en route, space has been expanding. The light has stretched. So the actual appearance of it is much, much fainter than a galaxy that would be 10 billion light years away. And then C, where the galaxy is now, because it traveled during all that 10 billion years in which its light was traveling to us, is nowhere near where we seem to be seeing. It would have to be at least 30 billion light years away today. So just to allay all of that confusion about observing things in an expanding universe, we simplify it, and the media just say the galaxy is 10 billion light years away, but it really isn't.
And that's why astronomers drink. It's funny. Scott, thanks a lot.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, when I was a kid, back in the early 70s, it was postulated that the universe was circular. And so I always thought, if you had a strong enough telescope, you could see the back of your head.
You could. And you know what? That was valid. Until the infinite universe became more and more plausible in very recent times, it was absolutely valid that if our sun were old enough, the fly in that ointment is that our sun hasn't been around long enough for the light to have made one circumference of the universe, which might have taken 200 billion years, and the sun has only been around for 5 billion years. But if the sun were infinitely old, yes, you could look out there and see our own sun and even our own Earth, the backside of it.
Wow. All right, but that's now pretty well discredited, though, right?
Yeah, it looks that way.
Okay, so much for dreams. Let's go to Todd in New Lebanon. Todd.
Hi. As an aside, first of all, Ray should read the Heliconia trilogy. I don't know if Bob Berman is familiar with
it. Is it sci-fi stuff?
No, it's the book. It's three books.
It's a sci-fi writer?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I've never... My brother, big into the sci-fi, I've never really read any to speak of. Childhood's End, that's about it.
He's the one who dreamed about sending a interstellar... ship and how it would have to be equipped and what happened on the way.
Oh, very interesting.
But anyways, for Bob, I hadn't heard the theory of this infinite universe, and I was wondering, does that have any implications for the basic laws of physics? I mean, especially the cosmic speed limit or anything like that?
No, not for light, but it certainly would change around almost every... thing else that we can think of. And let me address what you said by saying that it's not that an infinite universe is a theory to explain something else. The infinite universe would rather be just an observation that we seem to be seeing a flat topology of space. And there are many, many different observations that are pointing to this flat topology. We compare redshift with the Hubble constant. We look at type 1a supernovae. We use baryon acoustic oscillations. There's a lot of different areas of evidence, and they're all pointing to an infinite universe. So an infinite universe is really seems to be a fact, or it's approaching being a fact rather than an answer to something else.
Okay. Todd, thank you very much. By the way, we were talking during the break, and I completely forgot, you're headed to Australia very soon.
That's right, Saturday.
This is the big one.
Yes, yes. I mean, total eclipses are the greatest thing.
Solar eclipse, right?
Yes, solar eclipse. You know, partial eclipses are kind of nice. Lunar eclipses are kind of nice, but a total solar eclipse, that's when the stars come out in the daytime, when those tongues of nuclear flame leap out of the edge of the sun and people weep and animals go crazy. It's really a life-changing experience. It far outdoes the other great celestial things you could see, like a great display of the northern lights or a great comet. And that's why people travel to them. About 3 out of 4 years, there's one somewhere in the world, and it takes place in a tiny little fraction of a foreign country. The path of the moon's shadow is always very small, and we haven't had one here in New York State since 1925, and we're not going to have another one until 2079.
Oh, for Pete's sake.
So they're hard to see, and that's why we're taking a group to Cairns, Australia, and that the eclipse itself will happen on November 13th.
Well, it's exciting. So you bring about 40, 45 people with
that's
you,
right.
and
that's
wow,
right.
good time. All right, let's go to Jim in Kingston. Jim.
How do you do, Ray and Bob?
Hello.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Great.
Oh,
okay.
Maybe you could turn your radio down or something. We're having a little echo there.
I have my radio off.
Okay.
And, just two questions real quick. One is in relation to Planet X or Nirubu, and what you can let us know about its course, its orbit. And the other question is in relation to the galactic alignment, which is supposed to happen on 12/21.
Yes.
Those two questions, if you could please.
Okay. Now, the planet, that Urubu thing, it's make-believe. No such thing exists. The alignment with the galactic core, that's also make-believe. Now, you have to understand that with this Mayan calendar, one of their calendars is coming to an end. The 13th Baktun is beginning, you're right, on the winter solstice, December 21st. That's a calendar from one old culture. They turn the page and begin the next Baktun. That's a fact.
But this Nirubu thing has gone back decades now, well before the Mayan
yes.
calendar.
And what they're doing, what people have tried to do is to give this kind of validity that there really is an Armageddon or a change on the Earth or a major thing happening by saying just as this Mayan calendar is flipping, the galaxy is aligning with the sun or with the Earth or this planet Nirubu is coming. But all of that is make-believe. See, we've never had a previous Armageddon that was based on nothing before. You know, remember Y2K? That had a basis.
Yeah.
Remember the Heaven's Gate cult that was following Comet Hale-Bopp?
Yeah.
Well, you know, nobody really thought there was a flying saucer following the comet, but at least there really was a comet heading in this direction. When we've had planet right. alignments, we know the planet alignments don't harm Earth. But at least there was an actual planet alignment around which the Armageddon people were basing their fears. This is the first time that astronomers are seeing absolute fictitious make-believe stuff for December 21st. There is no alignment with the galaxy's center. The sun has the same apparent path through the crosses the galactic plane twice a year. Every single year, never varies, never, never, ever varies. Nothing is special that's happening this year. And there is no such planet that has never been known and is approaching us. So please believe us, nothing will happen. On December 21st, you will find the day precisely the same as the day before. I wish I could make some money off this by setting up an insurance company. But I can't think of any ways to do it.
Hang on. Go ahead, Jim. There's an echo on our line, Jim, but go ahead and make another follow-up.
Pulsation coming from the heart of a Milky Way galaxy. Do you know anything about that?
A what?
A pulsation, he's saying.
Okay.
No, this is fictitious. There have always been radio waves, in fact, from a black hole called Cygnus X1, weighing 4 million times what the sun does. There are black holes at the heart of every single galaxy, including our own galaxy. There's nothing special about it. And it's a source of radio waves and always has been. So there's nothing different about it or exciting about it, in particular.
All right, Jim, thanks a lot. Let's go to Jerry in Schenectady. Jerry, you're on with Bob Berman.
All right, thank you. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Hello.
Bob, in the past, sometimes you've mentioned that there are four different sources of energy or heat for Earth, and you've mentioned the sun, and you mentioned the oceans. And I thought, well, don't the oceans get their energy from the sun? But I was thinking, why would you consider the oceans separate? Are there a lot of underwater volcanoes that give the ocean its own?
No, you're quite right. And I think what you're talking about is in the discussions about climate change and
yeah.
how much anthropogenic climate forcing is responsible for the changing climate, and the climate really does seem to be changing, and how much we could blame, let's say, the sun or other things. In recent years, there have been some excellent models that have shown that everything we see year after year with the global temperatures makes sense if there are four factors that are responsible for the climate. One of them is, of course, the amount of carbon dioxide we humans are putting in the air. The other is the sun's changing emissions. We had a very quiet sun just 5-6 years ago. Now the sun is more active with solar max next year. That has a certain effect. The other two effects are the presence or absence of volcanic eruptions. In times like when we had Pinatubo back 20 years or so ago, when you have a lot of atmospheric dust in the you know, in the air from volcanoes, that cools the planet briefly for a few years. And the fourth factor is the one you mentioned, the oceans. Mm-hmm. Now, the oceans are a huge heat sink, as you can imagine, because of their mass. Any global warming is more showing itself up in the oceans than in the air and on land, just because there's so much water. And so when the oceans warm by a degree or two, as they have, that's a huge amount of heat that's being held. But when we're talking about what's contributing to any year's temperatures, it's the presence or absence of an El Nino, which, as you probably know, is Pacific Ocean warm water rising to the surface and affecting the air above that. And in El Nino years, there's a contribution to global warming for that year and for the next year that's equal to anything the sun can do. And so that's one of the four factors.
Hmm, interesting. Okay. Jerry, thanks.
Okay. Thank you.
I appreciate it. Bob Berman is our guest. Dennis in Albany, you're next.
Hello. Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
Yes, it's a great topic. I wish this was a weekly topic. I just wanted to ask you about the laws of probability. Now, there are just roughly how many stars in our galaxy? Just roughly.
Roughly 400 billion.
400 billion. And there's 100 billion galaxies, right?
Right. Some say 200 billion within view.
Right. And they're detecting that. Now, NASA is detecting these planets going around these stars.
Yeah, there's probably planets around most or all stars.
Right, right. So is it the fact that we are just so, you know, all-knowing that we're the only life in the universe, or is it just that we don't know, that we're just like, you know, critters floating in the ocean, thinking that we're the only ones floating in the ocean?
Well, I don't know if people really think that anymore. You know, there was a time when some of the theories for life really revolved around unique conditions on Earth, and that there was a good chance that we'd be the only life. But now that we've seen that the building blocks of life, the amino acids, are on comets, and perhaps on asteroids as well, and that there could be a kind of seeding process where at least the building blocks of life fall on planets everywhere throughout the universe, maybe even simple life, maybe even bacteria survive and are seeded onto planets. So now it seems equally plausible, if not more so, that maybe life is everywhere. That panspermia idea of life being seeded through space is kind of an attractive one. And you know how we'll know? When we can get to Europa and survey the warm, salt oceans, because that's what it is, warm, salty oceans, underneath the ice sheets of Jupiter's moon Europa. It's had the same conditions Earth has had in terms of bombardment by comets with amino acids.
Yeah.
If we don't find life in those oceans, that's going to tell us a lot,
yes,
about life being maybe really unique on Earth.
Thank you, Dennis. You know, the Drake equation and the probability of finding life, I always had a great problem with it because, frankly, you're making that one variable up. In other words, if you find one microbe anywhere, then all bets are off. Then you can assume that there is life teeming everywhere. But until you find that one microbe, you're just guessing, man.
That's right. And the Drake equation is really a guess. You know, we were talking earlier about habitable zones around each star. Where is the area that's where a planet would be kind of like Earth is? But how do we know we need Earth-like temperatures? You know, if we find life in Europa, Europa is far out of our solar system's habitable zone.
Right.
And yet there is as likely as not life. So it'll change everything once we know that. Plus, Ray, how do we know that the whole universe isn't, I mean, this is going to sound far out there,
isn't alive, yeah,
that consciousness and the universe aren't correlative. That
I'm so glad you brought this up with 1 minute to go, by the way. I appreciate that very much. But you make a great point. What is life? Is our definition too constricted? So this is great. All right, I'll tell you what. Jim in Greenfield, you've been waiting. I apologize, sir. You got about 30 seconds to ask, Bob has 30 seconds to answer. Go.
Hello?
Hello, Jim. You got 30 seconds, buddy. Go.
You just answered the question I had. My question was, how do you know that the third planet from the sun is the ultimate ideal place for life to exist? So you just answered my question.
That's ESP. That just proves that ESP is real.
Another satisfied customer.
Fantastic.
I mean, I waited online. It was perfect.
All right, Jim. Well, at least we got you on the air. Thank you, my friend. Well, you know, but you did say earlier that the Proxima Centauri, the planet there, was so close that it would be 1,000 degrees. You're sure that life can't exist at 1,000 degrees?
I'm not sure of anything anymore.
Good way to end the program. Bob Berman, our guest. The most recent book is The Sun's Heartbeat. It's on Little Brown. I recommend that you read this. It's a great book, and anyone can understand it. Best part about the book. Bob Berman, we will see you next time, my friend.
Thanks, Ray.
Support for WAMC comes from United Way of the Greater Capital Region, Albany, New York. Live United, give, advocate, volunteer, UnitedWayGCR.org. Boyden and Perron, Amherst, Massachusetts, offering lawn and garden equipment, parts, and service to customers throughout Western Massachusetts, a family-owned business for over 50 years, BoydenandPerron.com. And The Albany Show, 40 dealers of antiquities, jewelry, and decorative arts, November 9th and 10th. Holiday gifts and more at St. Sophia Greek Orthodox Church on Facebook. All right, that's it for this week on Vox Pop. Thanks to Zach Malloy for his sterling service. Christy Carton answered the phones today. Patrick Donges, our producer, is on an off day today. But we did okay. We had the scripts shuffled. Everything worked out in the end. Thanks to everybody who called in. Moyers and Company at this time tomorrow. On Monday, it's Alan with Medical Monday. Have a great weekend.